I noticed there's an emergency clause on this bill.
Okay.
And this morning you told me you didn't like emergency clauses on your plan.
What I said was, this one here, the emergency clause is for we're talking about shutting down the operation. That's basically
so we probably can't
selling these kits into the board. So, the reality is we don't want them.
Call to be back to order.
Thank you. Senator Przanski, please.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairs and committee members. For the record, Floyd Przanski, State Senator, District 4, including parts of Lane and Douglas counties. I want to thank the chairs for being willing to schedule Senate Bill 376A to the as quickly as you have. This bill here is going to do simply one thing. It's going to actually create a, let's say, a supplemental crime to actually charge individuals or could charge individuals who are selling items or objects for value or for consideration that could, in fact, are capable of causing death and actually advertising them or putting them out for that purpose. In other words, suicide kits. This came to my attention when a reporter from Eugene contacted me about a young man who had committed suicide using one of these kits. I had not heard of these kits, and she asked me if I'd heard about a helium hood or helium suicide kit, and I said no, I had not. She suggested, and I did go up online and actually was able to see it being prominently displayed and actually offered for sale. It turns out that there is no checks and balances on these whoever's buying these kits. Basically, for this one particular company, you send $60, and what you get back is this. This is a suicide kit that actually was, in fact, used. I'm not going to elaborate by opening up and showing everything in there. If you are interested in that, you're more than welcome to do so. But the bottom line is, I took the position after hearing about this that we needed to basically make a stand. This is a time and opportunity for us to say no to individuals who are trying to profit on individuals who I believe in many cases are suffering from a depression or maybe some other type of mental health issue that they have not had the ability to rationally think through the decision. Let me give you a little bit of background for myself as to one of the reasons I thought this was worth moving forward. When I lived in Houston, Texas, I worked for an organization called Crisis Hotline. It's a nonprofit organization, 24/7 intervention services. I started off as a volunteer. As I went through law school, I became their night staff, and so I fielded many phone calls from volunteers as well as when I was on the phones of individuals who were calling, reporting and that they were going to commit suicide, but they were reaching out to us, and they had many individuals that after we had the opportunity to talk to them and explain to them, one of the reasons they were reaching out to us is telling me or the volunteer that was answering that phone that they really didn't want to do that and they shouldn't be making such a rash decision, a permanent solution to a temporary problem. And in my discussions with many of those individuals, they would call back after the episode to only to thank us or the volunteers because they truly didn't realize that what they were faced with, what they saw as their dilemma, as something that was going to pass and they could move forward in life. One of the concerns I have is because there is no checks and balances on these companies that are selling this and profiting, that minors have the access, direct access to this product. And you can only imagine how many times you've heard in just in maybe in your own life when you had your first love, a boyfriend, girlfriend, and they basically said it was over, how you might have felt in your life as to the tragedy of this and life isn't worth living. And so those are the types of scenarios and situations that I don't believe that we want to even have this stuff available. I am a strong supporter of the Death with Dignity Act that we have in the state and have supported it and will continue to support it. I do understand that in my discussions with some individuals in my district as to why they think that maybe something like this should be available because people who may want to use Death with Dignity may not be at the point in their life where they can actually accomplish that because they're gone too far to the point of we're not able to seek the medical review that's necessary, etc. But I guess what I would say is that when you know that in this particular, these type of kits, basically it is a hood, a plastic hood with plastic tubing, and you can go up on the internet and you can get all that information. You can go into your garage, you can go into your pantry, and you can pretty well put the own kit together. I don't think it's appropriate and necessary for us to make it convenient for people to take that step, even though I support it, and I know that from my own life experience with both my parents, but specifically my father, and how he suffered months on before his final days, and how he had to rely on a morphine drip self-administered to try to control the pain. But at the same time, when there's no checks and balances and not absolutely nothing, and you have individuals that are basically, I feel, preying on people that are at a time in their life that they do not need to have the encouragement or the actual ability to buy a quick fix to commit suicide. That is why I was willing to bring forward the amendments that now became Senate Bill 376. You do have a set of amendments that to narrow this down in dash A5s, and basically what we wanted to do when we looked at the original passage, what we passed out of the Senate, we realized that it was one that would require a proof of the individual who sold the kit that the purchaser of the kit actually intended to use the kit for committing suicide. We believe that is a burden that's overwhelming and would be very hard to do. And so what we've done with the A5s is we basically have now limited it to the knowledge of the individual who is selling or otherwise transferring for consideration this object that is capable of causing death to another with the intent that from their perspective that is being used to or made available to the person to in fact commit suicide. So the burden will be proving that the individual who's making these available to the receiver, that is their intent. We believe it's much more clean, it's much more succinct, and for those who think that somehow that maybe a loved one could be caught up in this situation where they may be trying to help their loved one have a means of extinguishing the pain that they're suffering. That is one of the reasons that we have in here that it has to be transferred for sale or for consideration. So you actually would, in fact, make certain that a family member who might do something to help their loved one to fulfill those wishes would not be caught up in this law. The last thing I want to address is what Representative Nolan brought up as to an emergency clause. The reason for the emergency clause is specifically we have this business ongoing as it is right now, making these available, and we feel that it's important to move forward and quickly to basically tell a seller who's outside of the state or one that's maybe inside the state that business is shut down, that this is not going to be allowed. It should be mentioned that, lastly, that 376 is kind of a subcomponent of manslaughter in the second degree. For those who are in law enforcement and for have been around the block as to charging instruments, a person can, in fact, be charged today under Man 2 for aiding and abetting someone committing suicide. So basically what this is going to do is kind of a carve-out, and it will, in fact, make certain people understand that if you're in the market and of selling items that you intend the other person to use to commit suicide, that is prohibited, and you will be charged accordingly.
Garrett, please.
Thank you. thank you, Senator Brzezinski. Did you say that, is that like a mail order thing? Is that how that's typically procured?
This particular one was through the internet, but it would work in the same way as a mail order. Basically, in this particular case, the purchaser of this item paid $60, gave them their address, and delivered to their door was a box with a suicide kit in it. Also, I should mention inside the box, besides the apparatuses that could in fact be used and capable of causing death, was also literature, a book by an individual here in the state. We call it Final Exit, Derek Humphrey's book. And so we have not been able to, let's say, tie the two together, but it seems kind of interesting that the literature would also be coming into the package with this kit.
Follow up. I'm just trying to figure out how this might play out in a couple scenarios where you have somebody. I mean, if it's an internet order where there's no communication other than a click of a button between the purchaser and the seller, how would one establish that the seller really had the purpose to assist someone he may not ever have met or spoken to? in doing anything.
Thank you for the question, Mr. Co-Chairs and Representative Garrett. I believe that the way this could be handled is based on how they present the item for sale. And if they are presenting it as a means to commit suicide, that they have accomplished their intent of telling the buyer, well, I have something here that will help you commit suicide.
Okay.
And in this particular case, my understanding, or I should say particular case, this particular organization, that there has been conversations in some cases where there's by phone, as by internet, and I also believe possibly by mail.
Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, how would you envision that someone in Oregon might enforce this law, should this bill become law? How would you envision that it be enforced against an out-of-state or out-of-country internet provider or vendor?
All right. Thank you for the question, Mr. Co-Chairs and Representative Nolan. During the testimony we had on the Senate side, we had Alex Gardner, the district attorney for Lane County, who came and gave testimony. He actually brought to our attention that we had originally had the bill written up as a Class C felony, and he stated that if we really wanted to make certain that he would have the power that he would need, it needed to be a Class A or Class B, so you could extract the individual from the other state. And so it's going to be one that the based on a Class B felony, district attorney's office would in fact be able to review a case on a case-by-case basis and determine whether or not they want to bring charges against someone who is selling this item into the state.
Follow up, if I might.
Follow up.
Thanks. So you're anticipating then that prosecutors here would go to other states and pursue extradition to bring an internet supplier in North Dakota or Ontario or India to face charges here in Oregon?
Mr. Co-Chairs and Representative Nolan, that would be the decision of the district attorney who was reviewing the case. I've been told that, we do extradite people from other states for various crimes, and this would be just another one that could be. One of the things we do believe is that when people realize, and this is one of the reasons we're wanting to break it out as a separate statute, that when they realize that they would be faced with that potential outcome, that in itself will shut down that business as it pertains to the state of Oregon.
One more follow-up, if I may.
Follow-up.
Are there any other states that have pursued that tactic, and do we know whether it's been successful?
The answer to the question, Mr. Co-Chairs and Senator, Representative Nolan, my understanding there are no other states at this point. I can tell you there's been a number of states that have started looking at what we are proposing and moving forward. I do know in the state of Georgia that there has been a district attorney who is looking at someone that has been, let's say, a little more directly involved in the sense of actually at a suicide that took place where some of the information that I've received, I believe, a similar type of kit was used, and because of that, the providers of that kit are no longer selling to anyone in the state of Georgia.
Thank you.
You bet.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So thank you, Senator Brzozinski, for bringing this bill to our committee. So as I'm reading the bill, would it apply to someone who is providing a firearm to somebody knowing another person when they know they would be using it to commit suicide?
The way the bill is, thank you, Mr. Co-Chairs and Representative Tomei, the way the bill is written, it basically says any substance or object that is capable of causing death. So in answer to your question, if someone said, I have a firearm that I will sell to you or give it to you for value for the purpose of you committing suicide, yes. If someone transferred a gun to someone, just as we do on a day-to-day basis, without any knowledge as to how that gun is going to be used or promoting it to be used for that purpose, no.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Krieger.
Gracious, we got the gun legislation.
Yeah.
I believe, Senator, you and my office, was it Thursday regarding this bill? We just visited briefly.
Yes.
I need to take a lesson on how to get bills hearing that fast. It's a good bill.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Anything further? Thank you, Senator. Appreciate your testimony.
All right. I want to thank you and also the committee. We'll be hearing from Zach Konowski shortly, and I just want you to understand that Zach and his brother, Jake, have been very instrumental in bringing this information to me. It was his brother who took his life under the same means, and I just wanted to thank them for being willing to come forward and actually explain the reasons why they think this is important legislation.
Okay, and at the present time, we're in public hearing only. We don't have the fiscal back on that.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next call, Zach Klonsky, please. Klonsky. Please go ahead and remember to identify yourself for the record.
My name is Zach Klonsky. Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, and members of the committee, I appear before you today with a heavy heart and a strong support of Senate Bill 376. The last time I testified before a House committee, I did so with my brother, Nick Klonsky, by my side. Today, the chair next to me is empty. On December 17, 2010, my brother Nick took his own life. The gravity of the loss to my family and I cannot be put into words, so I will not attempt to convey to you the devastation I feel every second of every day. What makes Nick's story even more troubling is the method he chose to employ to take his own life. My brother ordered what can best be described as a suicide kit, an easy-to-follow manual with all the necessary parts included except for a helium tank. However, as the suicide manual points out, a helium tank can be easily obtained from any business that offers helium tanks for blowing up balloons. The manual even goes out of its way to instruct the user to ask for a party balloon tank rather than a helium tank to avoid suspicion. With no background checks on who is ordering these kits, the GLAD company is mailing these suicide kits out every day to whoever happens to stumble across their website and place an order. In a society where so many people suffer from depression and other mental health problems, this company has found their niche in the market, peddling death. This is analogous to putting a gun vending machine next to a depression clinic. It may be good business, but it cannot be allowed. The GLAD company, so named as to avoid suspicion in case a family member happens to sign or come across the package, made $60 off my brother's death. We cannot sit idly by and watch this group continue to make a profit by preying on vulnerable members of society. My family and I don't know if Nick would still be alive without the existence of the GLAD company, a company that makes a profit by advocating for people to give up, but I do know that I will be haunted by that question for the rest of my life. The helium hood method of suicide is extremely effective, and as a result, people who attempt suicide employing that method rarely, if ever, survive. I cannot help but think of a close family friend who was suffering from severe depression and attempted to take his own life by driving his car into a tree. He was severely injured, but he survived. Today, less than 5 years later, he is married and has two beautiful children and is extremely happy. I doubt my friend would still be alive today had he happened to come across GLAD's website. Now, while I had never heard of the helium hood method of suicide before I became all too familiar with it after Nick's death, this is not an isolated incident. As reported in a recent Register Guard article, the GLAD company has an estimated annual sales of $98,000, equal to the price of 1,633 kits. Very troubling and symbolic of the prevalence of this problem was the response to police officers that first responded to the scene of Nick's death. As more officers arrived, they simply asked the first responders, "Is it the book and the kit?" Without any more explanation, the first responders answered, "Yep." We cannot allow this to go on. These types of organizations have been allowed to live in the shadows for far too long. I urge you to support Senate Bill 376 so no other family has to go through what my family is going through and will continue to go through. With the sale of one of these helium hood kits, the GLAD company smashed my family into a million pieces. We are broken, and we will remain broken for the rest of our lives. Please don't allow another family to be destroyed by this shameful group. In closing, I just want to say that my brother Nick was a beautiful person. He loved politics, sports, the University of Michigan, his family and friends. He excelled academically, and he had political instincts far beyond his age. He fought his entire life for social justice and cared deeply about his community, state, and country. It would be a disservice to him to remember him for the way he died and for this bill. I ask you to remember and honor him by always standing up for the vulnerable and voiceless members of society, those people who may not possess great financial or political power, but nonetheless are the majority of the people you represent. Thank you for allowing me to testify. I also have a brief message from my brother Jake, who couldn't be here because he's studying for his law school finals in California. Thank you very much for taking the time to hear from Zach and I today. Senate Bill 376 will certainly not stop all suicides, and in the tough financial times of the present day, I hope you will all also fight to protect funding for mental health programs that likely do more than criminal penalties to save lives. Still, a society is defined in part by the behaviors it refuses to tolerate. I think we must refuse to tolerate people making money from the pain and suicides of our brothers and sisters. It is my prayer that this bill ensures no one will open the door to a loved one's room and find a suicide kit and an autographed how-to book next to the body of someone they love. Or find a receipt stating that a company made $60 off a loved one's death. The pain of that experience is beyond words. Thank you for taking the time to consider this issue. It is likely not one of the things you came to Salem to work on, but if it saves even a single life, there is little of higher value you can do. I'm sure if Nick were here, he would agree. There's no one I know more eager to support those in need of help than he was, and no one more opposed to valuing making money over protecting lives of the vulnerable in our society. Again, thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony, and we recognize the great difficulty that you're going through in your testimony. We appreciate that you would come before us, and thank you very much. I know I speak for the committee.
Welcome.
Okay, we don't have the fiscal yet for the amendment, so we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 376A. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 398.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Senate Bill 398 would modify the crimes of intimidation, both the first and second degree, to include offenses committed because of the offender's perception of a victim's disability. This would add disability as a protected class within the statute alongside race, color, religion, sexual orientation, and national origin. The relevant definition of disabled person would be a person having any mental or physical impairment which substantially limits one or more major life activities, has a record of such impairment, or is regarded as having such an impairment.
Thank you. Bob Junedep, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Bob Junedep. I'm the Director of Disability Rights Oregon. The bill before you really is the result of meetings that I have had over the last 2 years with groups of people with disabilities to discuss issues that they've thought might be appropriate to bring before the legislature. And in somewhat many people who experience disabilities, those being intellectual disabilities, physical disabilities, mental health issues, have expressed vulnerability in their communities, feelings that they are taken advantage of, harassed, or actually physically accosted while on the sidewalk, while participating in regular activities. Oftentimes, it's unclear exactly why that happens. It's most likely, I would think, as a result of those individuals' obvious vulnerability to victimization. In doing some research, I found some statistics nationally about the rate of victimization of people with disabilities, and I provided you with my testimony a 2008 summary from the Bureau of Justice Statistics of the U.S. Department of Justice going over what the rate of victimization is of people with disabilities. And as you can see, it's significantly higher than it is for able-bodied individuals. Again, this is most likely, in my assessment, a result of obvious vulnerability, but there are instances in which people are singled out for victimization because they have a disability, because of the attacker's animus toward that group, particularly people with intellectual disabilities and mental illness that can render them homeless and easily vulnerable. The bill before you today does one simple thing, is it recognizes that Oregon has taken seriously the problem that individuals can be singled out, not because of something that they did, something that of being in the wrong place or the wrong time, but because of their identity as part of a group. We have provided protections to people because of race and other categories when a perpetrator victimizes a person because of their membership in that group. Oregon has not had provided this type of protection for people with disabilities in the past. We feel that it is an appropriate thing to do. And that is what Senate Bill 398 would accomplish. Now, on the Senate side, there was some concern from some committee members, Judiciary Committee members, that in some way that this bill would penalize freedom of speech or other protected constitutional freedoms, because what it says is that a person is protected from being attacked because of their membership in a group or their perception that they are a member of that group. And some committee members felt that, well, gee, people's perceptions shouldn't be penalized. When in fact, what our statutory framework says is that what is being prohibited and potentially penalized is a person's actions in victimizing another person or attacking another person. When it comes to the motive for that attack, the motive that is being receiving the penalty is the motive of attacking a person because of their membership in a group or because the victimizer believes that person is a member of that group. And so the word perceived is used to gather in the idea that if a person can be proven to have attacked someone beyond a reasonable doubt because of their membership in the group, then that would receive a criminal penalty. And that's what this bill would extend the protection to people with disabilities as it has provided it for other groups. And I am, of course, open to answer any questions that you might have.
Any questions?
Thank you very much.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 398. Open a work session on Senate Bill 398.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 398 to the floor if it do pass.
Representative Krieger moves Senate Bill 398 to the floor if it do pass. Is there any discussion? Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Just a note, my reading of this is that most of the conduct is currently covered by alternate statutes. Not that I'm saying I'm not going to support this, but just largely staff purposes, is so that we know what we're voting on. I mean, person commits the crime of intimidation in the second degree in a misdemeanor if the person intentionally subjects another person to offensive physical contact. That would be harassment, also ultimately charged as a B misdemeanor. So basically we're elevating that from B misdemeanor to A misdemeanor. Given the perception, or in the event of the perception of disability in this case, tampers or interferes with property having no reasonable ground to believe that the person has such a right, this is at least a C misdemeanor under criminal mischief in the third degree, so we're elevating that, not based upon, of course, it would be a factor of the value of the property, so basically we're elevating from a C misdemeanor to an A misdemeanor based upon the person's perception of disability. Sometimes, exactly. This is the potential for it, for what we're voting on here. Well, it is, this is you know, it bears, I think, examination of what it is we're doing here. And so, again, and then in the C paragraph, intentionally, because of the person's perception of disability, threatens the person or a member of the person's family, this would be typically menacing. Another A misdemeanor, though, the portion about threatening another person's family is an additional element to menacing, so that would distinguish this crime from menacing in my reading of it. So it doesn't necessarily elevate the conduct, but it does add another factor to what could be charged here by the state. Inflicting serious physical injury upon a person, menacing. So I do want to note, I mean, this is a minor change, but it does bring, I think, disability in accordance with other portions of the law that are carved out, and so I just thought that was important for the committee to understand before we go forward.
Thank you for that. Any further questions?
I just want to thank Representative Hicks for explaining this to me.
What he's here for.
God bless him.
Any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Olson. Aye. Representative Tomei. Aye. Representative Wan. Excused. Representative Lisman. Aye. Representative Co-Vice Chair Hare. Aye. Co-Vice Chair Garrett. Aye. Co-Chair Krieger. Aye. Co-Chair Barker. Aye. Motion carries.
Representative Olson will be the carrier, please.
Please. Thank you.
Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 414A.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Senate Bill 414A modifies the procedures under which a creditor who holds a small estate affidavit may proceed against the small estate of a deceased creditor, specifically making modifications as to what obligations would adhere to a financial institution who has the safety deposit box of that person and what steps they must take to make that the contents of that box accessible to any creditor.
Thank you. Ken Sherman, please. Thank you. Please identify yourself for the record.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, I'm Ken Sherman. I represent the Oregon Bankers Association. This is a bill that's designed to fix a technical problem that we discovered over the last year or so with regard to banks and credit unions that hold safe deposit boxes for their customers. When the customer dies and the customer is the only lessee on the box, sometimes the customer will have an estate that's small enough to qualify for the small estate statutes. And as you know, in Oregon, if your estate consists of less than $75,000 of personal property and less than $200,000 of real property, then rather than going through the whole probate process, there's kind of a quicker way that the estate can be administered through the filing of a small estate affidavit. Certain people under the statute are permitted to file the affidavit, and then once that's filed, they can present that affidavit to any person who holds property belonging to the decedent and obtain that property, use it to pay the bills of the decedent, and then distribute the balance of the property pursuant to the decedent's will or the laws of Oregon. The problem that we've run into, very simply, is that technically when a bank rents a safe deposit box to a customer, the contents of that box are legally regarded as being in the possession of the customer and not the financial institution. And the statute that we're seeking to amend here says that if you're in possession, using that legal term, then turn the property over to the person who presents this affidavit to you. So the banks have been concerned, and the credit unions, about the application of the statute in that situation. And that's really what this bill is designed to fix, to allow and to require a financial institution in that situation to turn the property over to the person who is presenting the small estate affidavit. The process for doing that is designed to make sure that that property is treated appropriately and that the small estate affidavit process is used only in appropriate circumstances. So when the person who's filling out this affidavit determines that there is a safe deposit box in the name of the decedent, they have to go to the institution and have performed an inventory of the contents of the box and then take that information into account in putting together the affidavit. And remember, one of the things the affidavit has to say is that all of the personal property doesn't add up to more than $75,000. So if they file the affidavit and then discover the fact that there is a box, and I've had that happen in a number of estates, then this provides that they have to kind of stop the works, go to the financial institution, and again have an inventory prepared, and then based upon the information that they get from that inventory, they would file a supplemental affidavit. If it's determined that the value of the property would take the total value over the $75,000 limit, then they'd have to stop the small estate process and go through regular probate. So that's basically the bill in a nutshell. I think it will be useful to make sure that the small estate affidavit can be used in those appropriate situations where the size of the estate doesn't warrant a full probate, and it will solve the problem that financial institutions now have with this technical question about possession. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Sherman, so you opened my box, and there's old grandpa's watching. Who puts the value on those kind of things? Who assesses, who makes up?
It's Mr. Co-Chair, it's the responsibility of the affiant, really. The law places that responsibility. It doesn't matter whether those things are found in the decedent's bedside drawer or safe at home or safe deposit box in the bank. I could conceivably see the situation where they would bring in somebody who would appraise or otherwise provide some information about the value of those items.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 414A and open a work session on Senate Bill 414A. Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 414A to the floor. Representative Krieger moves Senate Bill 414A to the floor. Is there any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative
Nolan? Yes. Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Sofler?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Lubin?
Aye.
Co-Vice
Chair Hicks? Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett?
Aye.
Co-Chair Krieger? Aye. Co-Chair Parker?
Aye.
Motion carries. Representative Garrett, would you carry that for us, please?
Delighted.
Thank you. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 415A.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Senate Bill 415A would modify the penalty for the traffic offense of careless driving in the limited circumstance of if the commission of that offense of careless driving appears to have contributed to the serious injury or death of a vulnerable user of a public way. This would need to be specifically indicated by a police officer on a citation. And it would require the imposition of a specific sentence, namely the completion of a traffic safety course between 100 and 200 hours of community service, including activities related to driver improvement and traffic safety, the imposition and suspension of a fine of up to $12,500 with a year to receive the exoneration of that fine contingent on the completion of the other conditions with an extension grantable upon a finding of good cause.
Jonathan Manton, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairs and members of the committee. My name is Jonathan Manton. I appreciate you accepting my testimony today on behalf of Senate Bill 415. Several of the folks that were involved in this bill over on the Senate side and in the past were not able to make it today, so I just wanted to recount on their behalf some of the testimony in support of it. In the earlier committee, Attorney Ray Thomas testified that in his legal practice he's come across several police officers that are understandably uncomfortable with the current language of this bill because it requires them to make legal or medical conclusions about the severity of an injury or about causation before they write their ticket. And there was additional testimony from Captain Todd Wyatt on behalf of the Portland Police Bureau in support of this bill.
In his letter, he writes, Senate Bill 415 would provide discretion when using citations allowing law enforcement officers to note that the offense appears to have contributed to the serious physical injury or death of a vulnerable user, rather than requiring us to conclude the cause of the serious physical injury or death. This minor change will improve law enforcement's ability to enforce existing law and has our strong support. And then finally, there was testimony from a 74-year-old board member of the Portland Mountain Rescue. His name is Donald Adamski, and he was injured in an accident with a careless driver and had this exact circumstance happen where the officer just didn't feel comfortable making a medical determination to say that whether his injury was serious or not serious. It turned out he had 9 broken ribs, but it was hard to see on site. And so the purpose of this bill is to try to allow the officers to be able to say that the careless driving appears to have contributed to the serious physical injury or death, rather than requiring them to say that the careless driving contributed to the serious physical injury or death. And that's all the bill does. And so hopefully you'll support that bill. And thank you much for your time. Happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Sean, I can thank you for your testimony today. So what is the definition of a vulnerable user?
It's defined, it's ORS, I'm sorry, Mr. Co-Chairs and Representative Tomei, thank you for your question. It's defined in ORS 811.135, and they are pedestrians, highway workers, operators of farm tractors, skateboards, bicycles, roller skates, inline skates, and scooters.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
Representative Olson.
Yeah, Jonathan. When we're taking a look, I'm looking at page 2, section 2. It talks about the contributing factor issue for serious. I could be driving down the road and a bicycle pull out in front of me because the very nature that I am in that proximics right at that time and that bicycle pulls out in front of me, I become a contributing factor. How do you determine the difference of someone who is actually negligent of a culpable mental state type act versus just being in the wrong place at the wrong time?
Representative Olson and co-chairs, members of the committee, I think it's a great question, and I don't have the good answer specifically to it, but I can speak to what's in this bill, and this language only applies to careless driving. So it's already in this instance, there's a careless driver who, with an accident, who has contributed to the serious physical injury or death of one of these folks. In that case, it's only in that case for as far as this bill goes. So the driver would already be driving carelessly.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions? Thank you. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 415A. Open a work session on Senate Bill 415A.
Chair, I move Senate Bill 415A to the floor if they do pass.
Representative Krieger moves Senate Bill 415A to the floor with a due pass. Further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative
Nolan?
Yes.
Representative
Olson? Aye.
Representative Sockler?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Wong?
Excuse?
Representative
Lisnett?
Yay.
Co-Vice Chair Hicks?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett?
Aye.
Co-Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Co-Chair
Barker?
Aye.
Motion carries. I'll carry the bill. And we're going to roll Senate Bill 406 over. There's a possible amendment coming. Open a work session on Senate Bill 75, carried over from 519.
Members of the committee, Senate Bill 75 comes at the request of the Department of Corrections that makes permanent the provision that allows placing an offender on post-prison supervision on an inactive status. Chair, members of the committee, you have the Dashbone amendments in front of you that I got on behalf of the committee, which would put a 4-year sunset provision on the bill. We just got the fiscal impact statement as it relates to the Dashbone amendments. And this bill saves us approximately $1 million per biennium, the 2011-2013 biennium.
Council, there has been a little bit of debate on whether it should be for 2 years, whether we should sunset it for two or four, as the amendment said. Would you explain to us what your position, why you think we should go for a four-year sunset rather than a two-year?
Mr. Chairman, as a committee, 4 years just gives a little bit longer time to look at the issue. This is a provision that came from the last time we, you and I discussed it with Representative Krieger. It just brings it back to this legislature. When you look at the numbers that we received from Craig Prenz on expenses in prison populations, the graph was like this, and then it shoots up in the 2013-2015 biennium. So I think when we discussed it, it would make it a bit easier for the legislature not to have to readdress what is not really a big issue in the next biennium, when you're going to be facing continue to face difficult issues on budgets and criminal justice policies. That's a four-year sunset as opposed to the bill that was originally drafted, which would remove the sunset so it would be permanent law for ever and a day until it was changed.
Any discussion? Okay, we stand at ease for a few minutes. Chair, back to order, and close the work session on Senate Bill 75. Open a work session on Senate Bill 373.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Senate Bill 373 would modify the available methods by which a forfeiture counsel would file record of forfeiture with the Asset Forfeiture Oversight Advisory Committee. Basically, right now, there's an existing obligation to do it via hard copy. This would facilitate the transition to an electronic system. There is an amendment, and Craig Prince is here to talk about it.
Okay. Mr. Prince?
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. Thank you, council. I wanted to run through SB 373, make sure that my understanding from council that there was some question about what this one does, so I wanted to walk through this. You know, my staff's the asset forfeiture. Craig Prinz from the Criminal Justice Commission. I apologize. My staff's the Asset Forfeiture Oversight Committee. We have gone to an electronic filing, so folks don't have to file papers anymore. They just do it electronically. It's more efficient for, we think, the forfeiting agency and for ourselves. So sections 1 and 2 of the bill just direct that be done electronically. Section 3 eliminates the need for forfeiture counsel to send us a paper judgment, because we have the information. If we need to look at a paper judgment on a forfeiture, we can do so. So the bill itself just allows us to go to a streamlined electronic filing. I hope council handed out the Dash 2 amendments as well. The Dash 2 amendments, what it does two things. The first is it directs when the forfeiture counsel, so the attorney in the DA's office or whoever's doing it for the forfeiting agency, it says, please send us the electronic filing as soon as practicable so we can let the committee know how much money has been forfeited as close as real time as possible, and we can let them know how much money can be expected to be forfeited. So it's just, it goes to electronic monitoring and then says when the electronic information should be put in. The last thing I wanted to bring you to attention on the Dash 2s is in Section 5. Representative Olson is on the Asset Forfeiture Oversight Committee, and so I met with him in his office. I wanted to explain this one. Forfeiture goes back to the early 80s. Pete Shepard wrote these laws in the early 80s, and they wrote into the law that they wanted to look at, if you look at the language that we're taking out, it says that if in a biennium, if forfeiture comes in and it exceeds 115% of my agency's other fund limitation, we have to give it back to the forfeiting agency. I don't know why that was in, but in 2005, we changed a lot of the forfeiture statutes so that my agency is directed to give the 20% of the proceeds of forfeitures to drug courts from civil forfeitures and 10% to relief nurseries. So the amount of money that we actually get from a forfeiture, we pass through most of that from the state back to these county services. And we wanted to take that part out, because what we found is now that we get a larger percentage, we're actually getting close to that limitation. And we think the changes that were made in 2005 make this a necessary change. I don't think the intention was to have money that would have gone to drug courts or relief nurseries to go back to the forfeiting agency. So we wanted to update that. And that's what the Section 5 language does.
Questions?
Mr. Chair, Craig, do you have any idea how much money has been contributed toward drug court relief nurseries over the past couple of years?
I do. Co-chairs and Representative Olson, the great thing is civil forfeiture is starting to pick up again. And we at least, I want to say at least $200,000 we've got for drug courts during the recession when with the allotment reductions and the cuts to all the budgets, the drug courts were, you know, are over 80% of our general fund. So we've been able to use civil forfeiture money to keep the drug courts going. So I know it's been at least around $200,000, and we hope it'll be more next session.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Just to be clear, so the 20% from 2005, that's statutorily mandated that your agency pass that through to the drug courts. And then the 10% similarly to the relief nurseries is statutorily mandated. Okay, so then the 70% is then included in your other funds?
So is that co-chairs, Representative Hicks, before that, we only got 2.5% of the total. We didn't receive the 70%. It was part of the local disbursement. So part of the, and Representative Olson is more of an expert on this than I am, but part of the getting the 2005 legislation passed was that a portion of that forfeited money would be for drug courts and relief nurseries. So I don't want to leave you with the misunderstanding that we got all the money. Before 2005, we got 2.5% of the money, and that was only for staffing this oversight committee so we can do the reporting. And in 2005, they actually had a lot of the drug court money and relief nursery was then given to us to pass back to the counties. You really, you know, it's one of those, you know, in Josephine County, you would be, the grants pass, the city cops would do a bust. And then we would be the ones to take that and then give it to the county at the state level. In some of the counties, the local jurisdictions also do some of these type of things. But this was a legislative across the state thing to mandate that policy that we take some of the, you know, the money of drug traffickers and put it into drug courts and also to the relief nurseries where predominantly you're dealing with babies who we have a relief nurse to help with the parents on parenting them.
Council.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Just quick clarification. My understanding in the conversations we had with legislative council is that the dash twos were ultimately standalones. Were you looking for the dash ones as well? Or
yes.
The dash two? So you want both?
Co-chair, council, both, please. Let me make sure I understand. I'm sorry. The dash twos are standalone. I believe the dash ones were just the first sections, and then we added that language about the 115%. So I apologize, I misspoke. The dash twos are a standalone amendment.
That's what I thought.
Thank you. Sorry about that.
We are ready. We're going to have to move the dash twos.
Okay. Thank you.
Any more questions for Mr. Prinz?
Okay, thank you.
Dash twos.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendments into Senate Bill 373.
Representative Krieger moves the dash two amendments into House Bill, into Senate Bill 373. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 373 as amended to the floor if they do pass.
Representative Krieger moves Senate Bill 373 as amended to the floor if they do pass. Discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative
Olson? Aye.
Representative Wong?
Excuse.
Representative Lisnett?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hicks?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair
Garrett?
Aye.
Co-Chair
Krieger?
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker?
Aye.
Motion carries. Representative Olson will carry. And next I'm going to go back up the schedule and actually have a brief public hearing on Senate Bill 406. Call Deanna Ryerson, please.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, in Oregon, a lifetime suspension is 10 years, after which period you may petition the court for reinstatement. Senate Bill 406A modifies some of the parameters that would attach to this. Upon reapproaching the court for reinstatement, the two big changes. First of all, a defendant would be required to make such a petition in the county in which they were actually suspended. Currently, that can be done anywhere. Secondly, Senate Bill 406 provides that a court may not order reinstatement of driving privileges unless the person is able to provide proof that they've completed an alcohol or drug treatment program in an OHA-approved facility or a similar comparable facility.
Hey, thank you.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, Elizabeth Cushwell with the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 406. One of the reasons we're supporting the bill is because in first-time diversion cases, people are indeed required to go through some sort of a treatment program, whereas these people who have come on a 10-year revocation have not even been required to do that. So we feel it's only fair to do that. Ms. Ryerson is here from the Department of Justice. She can walk you through the specifics of the bill and the grounding.
Thank you, Co-Chair Barker and Co-Chair Krieger, members of the committee. I'm Dina Ryerson, Department of Justice. And just to explain what this bill does and the amendment to the bill, currently under the law, if somebody has been convicted of a third-time DUI, they are given a permanent driver's license revocation. That is among other provisions in the statute that require a permanent driver's license revocation, usually when somebody's been convicted of vehicular homicide of varying degrees involving a motor vehicle, their driver's license will be permanently revoked. This bill has to do with when somebody's trying to get their license back. Again, currently under the law, in order to get your license back from a permanent driver's license revocation, at least 10 years has to go by. At that point, the person can petition the court to get their driver's license back. Currently, the law states that the person will petition in the county in which they reside. So one of the first changes of the bill is to say they should petition in the county in which they got the driver's license revocation. Primarily because it's very difficult for the courts to get records, basically, from counties all over the state, let alone if the person resides, say, in Washington State. It's going to be difficult to do that. So it's beneficial for both the court for efficiency, the DA's office for efficiency, as well as for the person petitioning to get their driver's license back, because it will be a lot quicker for them to have a hearing and have the documents produced in the county in which the conviction happened. The second change would be that if a person during that 10-year period that the person's driver's license is revoked, they're not supposed to drive. And so the next change would be if the person chooses to drive a vehicle, even though their license is revoked, then they would, and they get a criminal driving conviction, let me clarify that. So not a driving while suspended violation for failing to carry a license or something. We're talking about a reckless driving conviction, a DUI conviction, or other criminal driving conviction. Then they wouldn't be eligible to get their license back for 10 years after the date of that criminal driving conviction. The third change would be to require them, once they petition to the court, to show the court that they at least completed one drug or alcohol treatment program. Currently under the law, someone with fewer DUI convictions has to show that they at least completed one drug or alcohol treatment program. And usually they have, if they've gone through probation and done what the court has asked them to do. Sometimes, in my experience, I prosecuted a quadruple vehicular homicide where the person had four prior DUIs, and that person was revoked off of every single probation and never completed a drug or alcohol treatment program during those, as a result of those convictions. And only to get his license back did he ever complete a drug and alcohol conviction or treatment program. And so this would be in line with the requirement for fewer convictions to get your license back. And that's it.
Okay. Questions? Okay. Thank you. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 406. Open the work session on Senate Bill 803.
Co-chairs, members of the committee. Senate Bill 803 would modify the definition of visual depiction of crimes relating to child pornography. It would also modify the definition of knowingly possess or control as it pertains to a visual recording of child pornography. Both of these modifications are essentially an expansion to capture individuals who access pornography on the Internet but do not purchase or save it to a physical hard drive.
This is exactly the same bill that we passed earlier.
We sent a bill over. Okay. We sent it. And that bill is going to be gutting stuff, so you might want to, I'm just going to send you a note, you might want to discuss that. But this is the bill that takes care of what we believe was not the court's error, but the court's ruling. Right. So, that, child porn. Is there any further discussion? Call the roll, please. make a motion first? Oh, I'm sorry, yes. That would be helpful.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 803 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Krieger moves Senate Bill 803 to the floor with a due pass. Call the roll, please.
Representative Nolan.
Yes.
Representative
Aye.
Representative Toss.
Aye.
Representative
Lemay.
Aye. Representative
Vaughn.
Sorry.
Representative
Elizabeth.
Aye.
Co-Vice
Chair Harris.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Krieger.
Stand by. Yeah. Co-chairs, apologies. There's a conflict amendment. I just remembered it at the absolute last second. So,
is everybody in possession of the conflict amendment? Was it distributed first thing?
Is that the dash?
This is the dash A3. Proposed amendments to resolve conflicts for Senate Bill 803.
Yes.
Sorry.
Yeah, procedurally, Mr. Chair, I'd like to withdraw the motion to move to the floor.
Representative Krieger withdraws motion on Senate Bill 803A. Council.
All right. And thank you again, co-chairs, members of the committee. 803A3 would reconcile a conflict with a potential conflict, which would be contingent on the passage of House Bill 2463. House Bill 2463 pertains to the affirmative obligation on individuals who develop film and do computer repair and in other ways in a professional context come into contact with child pornography to report that child pornography. The reconciliation is simply to port over the relevant change in the definition of visual recording so that it's operative in both bills, 803 and House Bill 2463.
Okay. Need to move the dash, please.
Move the dash A3.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the dash A3 amendments into Senate Bill 803.
Representative Krieger moves the dash 3 amendments into Senate Bill 803. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair,
I move Senate Bill 803
with the dash amendments to the floor
with a due pass. Representative Krieger moves Senate Bill 803 as amended to the floor with a due pass. Further discussion? Try it again. Call the roll, please.
Representative Nolan.
Yes.
Yes. Representative Olson.
Affirmative.
Representative
Sosa. Aye.
Representative
Tomei. Yes. Representative Warren. Excuse. Representative Lisman. Yes.
Co-Vice Chair Harris.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett.
Candy City.
Aye.
Co-Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Co-Chair Parker.
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Olson, please.
Thank you.
Is
there any further business to come before the committee?
Nope.
Committee adjourned.